Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Some events have long-lasting effects. We'll think through the 1953 coup in Iran and U.S.-Iran relations. Extremist marches aren't a new thing. We'll look back on the Nazi marches in Marquette Park with filmmaker Tom Palazzolo. And thousands of shell casings have been assembled to a portrait of Vladimir Putin. We're going to find out about the exhibit, Five Elements of War. Don't forget, you can join the conversation on Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. Tomorrow is the 64th anniversary of the coup in Iran. Let's reflect on the series of events unleashed by the U.S.-led coup on the government of Mohammad Mossadegh. We've got a terrific panel of people here, and we're going to start with Ervan Abrahamian, and he's a professor of history at Baruch College at the City University of New York. He's author of a shelf full of books about Iran, including, for our purposes, The Coup, 1953, The CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. Thanks very much for joining us, Ervan.
Hello, Jerome. Yes.
I wonder if you could there's some debate about what the 1953 coup was really all about. And it's easy to look back and say it was about oil or it was about the Cold War. There were 1,000 pages of recently released CIA documents in June that fleshed out some of the things you talk about in your book. What was the 53 coup really all about for the U.S.?
Well, the conventional wisdom is, of course, it's the Cold War. It was done in the height of the Cold War. The language of the period is the Cold War. So not surprisingly, when you look at the documents, much of it's couched in the context of the Cold War. But you have to take documents, especially public documents, with a pinch of salt, because every so often hidden in these documents is a mention about the sanctity of property, a sanctity of contracts should not be violated. And a major concern...
Sounds economic. For this,
economic. And a major concern, I think, both for the State Department, the American oil companies, was that if Iran succeeded in nationalizing its oil industry, this would have direct repercussions on American oil investments in throughout the world. And they mention this every so often. They don't cry it from the rooftops, but every so often you'll see a document saying that we have to be concerned about the repercussions of what's happening in Iran in places like Indonesia, Venezuela, Kuwait, Iraq, all these places where U.S. had investments. So I think there is a good reason to argue or debate which is more important, the Cold War or oil. My preference is that I think the oil was the main issue. If it was just the Cold War, they could have dealt with Mossadegh. They knew that Mossadegh was not a pro-communist. He was not really collaborating with the communists. There was no real threat either from the Soviets or from the Iranian Communist Party. In fact, the documents every so often that were released showed that the CIA did not expect either a Soviet intervention or the two-day ability to take over power. So from the realists, the people who were making the decisions, they knew really there was no communist threat to Iran. So, but they in their public statements, they were always talking about an imminent communist coup. So one has to take their public statements about communist fear really with a grain of salt. And I think their main concern, and these were very hard-nosed realists, the Dulles brothers, Eisenhower, these were not simpleton, naive people. they would look at reality and see that really there was no threat from the communists. And therefore, then why were they so concerned about getting rid of Mossadegh? And it wasn't just 1953. It's from the point from the day oil is nationalized, May 1951, there is a great deal of concern in Washington that the Mossadegh should not succeed in nationalization. Some people in the State Department thought they could sort of talk Mossadegh out of it or hoodwink him out of it, have some sort of formula where they would, in theory, accept the notion of nationalization, but that the oil industry would not be in the hands of Iranians to run. And, of course, for Mossadegh, their nationalization meant, for most people, would mean the same thing, national control over the resources.
Irvine Abrahamian is the author of The Coup, 1953, The CIA, The Roots of the Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. Also with us is Matteo Farzaneh. He's Associate Professor of History, and he's the principal with the Mossadegh Initiative at Northeastern Illinois University. And he's author of The Iranian Constitutional Revolution and The Clerical Leadership of Khorasani. Thanks. Nice to see you again, Matteo.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
You know, I wonder if you could flesh Mohammad Mossadegh out for us a little more. When we hear about like the nationalization of the oil resources of Iran, and obviously this is a big deal for the U.S. and for the British at the time, but he had a whole platform that he was trying to institute in Iran, lots of other things that were going to change Iran as we knew it, and that he's really popular for today, that people in Iran remember him for.
Absolutely. Mossadegh stands for everything that Iranians stand for from the perspective of sovereignty, independence, being totally independent and making their own decisions. And that was the highlight of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. That's what Khomeini kept talking about, the idea that we need to be independent. We need to get rid of the Western powers that are overpowering everything that Iranians wanted to do. So Mossadegh, in fact, is the father of Iranian sovereignty or the idea of nationalization that is directly related to this idea of economic freedom or economic prosperity. Today, Mossadegh enjoys a huge amount of popularity inside Iran and outside, but for a variety of reasons, we don't have anything actually named after him. The only major thoroughway that connects north of Iran, north of Tehran with the south of Tehran, about 16 kilometers long, was named after him at the beginning of the revolution, and all of a sudden, that name was replaced by something else. And that has a lot of political connotations, and the new documents that have come out that leads to pointing out to Ayatollah Kashani, who was a ally of Mossadegh for a while, but then he turned on him and became a sympathizer with the Americans and the British in the coup. That might have something to do with it, but we need more documents, I guess, and more research to find out.
You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald, talking with Matteo Farzaneh and Irvine Abrahamian. And I wanted to fold in John Limbert. John Limbert is now a distinguished professor of international affairs at the United States Naval Academy. And he's author of the book Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling with the Ghosts of History. And John retired as Ambassador Limbert, the highest ranking diplomat on the Iran desk when he retired as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran. And he was held hostage in Iran as a young foreign service officer for 444 days. Thanks for joining us, John Limbert. It's good to have you.
Thank you, Jerome. Good to be with you, and good to be with with all my learned colleagues.
How do you see the things we're talking about here, this throughway from 1953 to the Iranian Revolution? You were there. Could you feel that?
Indeed. I mean, this was one of the grievances that the revolutionaries had, and was one of the grievances that they had against the United States. Even though, as Dr. Farzaneh mentioned, the revolution came to reject Mossadegh's ideology, because his ideology was secular, and he resisted very hard any role of the clergy in politics. And even with that secular view, he was extremely popular in Iran. When we lived in Shiraz in the late 60s, one of the main traffic circles, everyone knew it as Mossadegh Circle, even though the official name was something else. But what he represented was really part of a long-going struggle, starting over 100 years ago, in which the Iranians were looking somehow to assert their sovereignty, their independence, and their dignity against foreign powers, British, Russian, and then more later American, which had come to dominate them politically and economically. And what Mossadegh saw very clearly unless we Iranians can control our one resource, our most important resource, which is our oil, which had been under foreign control since 1908, we will amount to nothing. We will never be an independent country. And this obviously struck a chord. I would also mention I'm a bit more inclined to the conventional Cold War wisdom behind it. I mean, I know this is debated and debatable, and obviously oil was a factor here. But particularly given the domestic political climate in the United States in the early 50s, and this overriding fear of communist expansion, it's really hard to I don't think you can minimize the importance of this. Now it does show in the documents. And I have, for example, there's an NSC study in late November 1952, which says the major United States policy objective with respect to Iran is to prevent the country from coming under communist control. Well, I think that's real. And as I say, it not only reflects an international view of the world, but also a view of American domestic politics.
Irfan Abrahamyan, did you want to have a retort to that?
Yeah, I wouldn't quarrel with John about what's in the statement, but I would question whether that's really a genuine sentiment. You can say the man in the street in America at that time was concerned about communism, but hard-nosed politicians like Dulles, Eisenhower, Kermit Roosevelt, they're not people sort of to be scared about phantoms. They're not looking under the bed to find communists. They would want to look at reality. You know, what are the cards? What strength do the communists have in Iran to take over? And interestingly enough, sometimes if they want to scare someone, they say, "Well, Iran would be like Czechoslovakia in 1948, where there was a communist coup." But if you look at the two countries, Czechoslovakia and Iran, you can't find two countries very different. In Czechoslovakia, you know, the communists had up almost 50% of the population. The CIA reports say that actually in 53, they say the two-day party had 2.3% of the electorate. Now, how are you going to take over power if you don't have actually any control over the military, over the police, the secret police? You have huge tribal forces that are armed to their teeth by the Americans, by the British, against the two-day. So it's quite complete fantasy to talk about the fear of communism. I mean, it reminds me of the idea of weapons of mass destruction. Now, did people really at the invasion of Iraq believe in that, or were they using this as an argument to carry out policies they wanted anyway?
Matteo Farzaneh, you want to weigh in here?
Sure. One thing that I think it's important from a historical and then from a realistic point of view, from a practical point of view, is that regardless of what the reasons were for the coup, 80 million Iranians at least 80 million, that's how many people we have in Iran, believe that U.S. Did something terribly wrong against the will of the Iranians, and that was the coup. So whether it was against Iranian nationalism and oil and money, or against the fear, or for the fear of the Cold War spreading and Iran becoming another Czech, I think we can look at it from a different perspective and say, regardless of what the reasons were, the outcome is the 1979 revolution. And if you look at the documents, if you look at the or read the interviews, listen to the interviews that are related to the JCPOA or the nuclear agreement, Mohammad Zarif continuously mentions this idea of distrust or mistrust between the United States and Iran. And that's still very much alive for Iranians.
John Limbert, I wanted to get your thoughts on, we've talked about the throughway from 1953 to the revolution, but what about from the revolution until now to the Iranian nuclear agreement? It's the hang time on the hostage crisis and getting over that for the United States is probably, well, we're still in it probably. I think there are a lot of people who are, still angry at Iran about that and bring that to their view of the nuclear agreement.
No, I agree with you. It's a festering sore, and it's a wound that's never been dealt with. At least American presidents and leaders, I refer to Secretary Albright, to President Clinton, to President Obama, have acknowledged what the United States did in 1953. In the case of 1979, it's been very difficult for the Islamic Republic to come to terms with it. And when they do, they look at it as something that happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And as long as that situation persists, you're going to have the kind of rhetoric that you heard in the United States during the arguments over the nuclear agreement, which was not to argue the merits of the nuclear agreement, but to say we should not make agreements with, quote, these people, that is, people who did this terrible thing, and then in parentheses, never acknowledged it. Now, you heard the same thing. The interesting thing is you heard the same thing on the Iranian side from opponents of the regiment, saying people who carried out the coup in 1953 or who did this and who did that, we can't trust them. How can we make any agreement with such people?
Irvand Ibrahimian, do you want to have a comment on that?
Actually, there's some ironic parallels. I think Khomeini was also a hard-nosed politician. In 79, he knew the U.S. did not have the infrastructure within Iran that it had in 53 to carry out a coup. But he was constantly saying the danger from United States of another coup. Again, if you look at his public statements, he's scared of United States of having carried out a coup. But I think his real agenda was that he wanted to humiliate United States, and the hostage crisis was a way of humiliating United States. So you have to really separate what the public rhetoric was with what his real goal was. Similarly, I think we go back to the 53. The rhetoric may be in the Cold War, but I think the reality was much more down to earth about, international agreements about oil and how that was going to affect the United States. One can constantly debate about what is stated is actually true or not, but one has to also put oneself into that context and see, did Khomeini really in 79 think United States had the infrastructure to carry out a coup, which is ridiculous. We know the CIA man in Tehran in 79 when he went out of the compound. He lost his way in Tehran. He had no no structure to be able to carry out a coup of the 53 type of style. It's complete a fantasy.
Matteo Farzaneh, you are the principal with a Mossadegh initiative at Northeastern Illinois University. What is that? What are you doing there?
Well, in 2013, Iranians across the U.S. and Europe raised about $250,000, and they dedicated a hall after Dr. Mossadegh, which is kind of strange because it's the only academic space or any space named after a deposed, democratically elected prime minister of Iran. And we're very happy that that has been done, and all the it's an endowment account, and all the incomes go back actually to Iranians and Iranian descent students as a way of scholarships. And we have an annual keynote lecture that we hold every year, and we talk about servant leadership because Mossadegh's main motto was that I am the servant of the people, and for that he paid a huge price after he was in a kangaroo court, sort of in a military court. He was sentenced to life in under house arrest, and he died there. So we talk about servant leadership, and Mossadegh basically serves as a model for that. And also, we are developing a new program in Persian language studies that we hope to raise enough to do that within a few years. And hopefully 2018 will be the first classes that will be offered Persian languages. And also we're going to have a competition, an international competition, where students and scholars will write articles about Mossadegh that will be published in a peer-reviewed journal.
Well, there's lots to do and lots to think about what's been happening with U.S. and Iran over the years. And thank you all for joining us and talking about the 64th anniversary of the coup in Iran, which is tomorrow. Matteo Farzaneh is with Northeastern Illinois University, where he is principal of the Mossadegh Initiative. Ervand Ibrahimian is a professor of history at the University of New York, and he's the author of The Coup, 1953, The CIA and the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iran Relations. And John Limbert is Distinguished Professor of International Affairs at the U.S. Naval Academy. His book is Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling with the Ghosts of History, and he's a retired Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran and was in the hostage crisis as a young foreign service officer in the American Embassy in Tehran. Thank you all for joining us and talking about the 64th anniversary of the coup in Iran.
Thanks for having us.
Extremist marches aren't a new thing. We'll look back on the Nazi marches in Marquette Park after the break. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for our Friday film contributor, Milos Stalik from Facets. It's good to see you, Milos.
Hey, Jerome. Great to be here.
And today we are going to talk up extremist marches. And these are nothing new in the United States. And you've brought a friend who is veteran at recording extremist marches.
Well, not only that, I think that Tom Palazzolo defines what an independent filmmaker is, a filmmaker of really unique vision and totally original voice, who's been making films for over 50 years and is part of history himself. And some of the films that he made document history, and long time before alt-right was in our nomenclature, he was there to film the Chicago Nazis.
Hey, Tom Palazzolo. I'm a huge fan of your films and work. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
We went back and I watched Marquette Park 2 last night, and you did Marquette Park 1 and Marquette Park 2, and these were where the Nazis came out and marched in Marquette Park, the Nazi party. And it was so much like what's happening today. The debates, the thing people are saying in the film, it sounds a lot like all this post-Charlotte talk that we're having. It's almost the same thing, it feels like.
In many ways, it sure does seem that way. Not quite as violent when I shot the events, because the police did a pretty good job of keeping the demonstrators away from the Nazis. But there is a lot of similarities.
What do you think? Everyone's debating the best way to deal with extremist marches and things like that. And in the film, they look so silly sometimes. They get out there and they forget their extension cord. And it's like 15 minutes of the film is these guys doing all this planning and getting out there and not having an extension cord. And then they're running around their Nazi shirts going and looking for extension cords. They look silly.
Yeah, you know, what attracted me, if I can use that word, to the Nazis is I read something early on that they had a march or they had a speech somewhere, and they drove up in their van. But then when they were being harassed by people, they forgot and locked their key in the car. So I knew these people were subjects for me. And
Well, so how did you get in there? I mean, how did you – I mean, you didn't just call up or show up at the door and say, here I am.
In fact, I showed up at the door. I taught at Daly College, and I showed up there and
They're being their headquarters,
there at Rockwell Hall, and – I told them, I talked to Frank, and frankly...
Frank Collin, who was the leader.
I talked to, I'm on a first name basis with Frank.
Oh, that's good.
I told him I was a teacher there, and that, you know, I liked, first of all, he was looking for publicity. And I said, I would like to shoot a film, and I'll be perfectly fair about it. I'll do it from both sides. And he, you know, he was thrilled that I would do that, and so I did the first film, which he loved, and so that gave me a chance to do the second film, which I had even more access, to his group. I was the only one allowed inside the headquarters there.
Yeah.
You said someplace in an interview, I think in the book Hollywood and Lake Michigan, that you found the neo-Nazis more pathetic and sad than anything else.
You know, I guess I have to say a part of me, of course, their message is horrible and awful. But if they'd only grown up in Oak Park, everything, it would be a different story, you know. They wouldn't be who they are. I think environment has a lot to do with people. And so
they were mostly in Market Park on the southwest side of Chicago. And what kind of community did they come from? What kind of background did they come from?
You know, I actually, they came in, I taught there at the City College there, and I never heard of any, there were no racist remarks that I heard of. But I think they drew people from other communities, and I'm not sure, I know at the big march that they had, they came in from all over. A lot of people, a lot of racist people. And I hope you want to mention that Rahm Emanuel is in the film. I went up to – he's with a group of people, and I came up with the camera, and Ron said, would you please get away from here?
And this was Rahm Emanuel as a young man.
Right. Yeah. He was shirtless, and he was macho, and ready to take on all the Nazis.
Yeah, the whole idea of the counter-protesters, there seemed to be a whole range of them from very thoughtful people to very people who just wanted to do violence, just like there is with the Charlotte thing.
Right. There are people who were arrested on the left too. You could see in the film the plainclothesman wore some kind of American flag little pin of some kind, and they were arresting some of the. Some of the right and left, they were arresting people.
You know, we've got a clip from the film of one of the more thoughtful protesters with a bullhorn, and she says a bunch of things that kind of are a lot of people still say these days.
Okay.
So they can't give better education to our kids, so they can't provide us with decent health care and decent facilities, right? But they have millions and millions of dollars to protect 12 crazy Nazis. They have millions and millions of dollars to build fascism in this country. They have millions and millions of dollars to kill workers. To kill workers in Chile. To kill workers in South Africa. To kill workers all over the world. But they don't have money to keep Cook County open. They don't have money to bring integration to the school.
There's some cogent complaints.
Right. So that was at a skirmish line. The police set up a skirmish line to keep the protesters from going to the park. The protesters, some of the other protesters, came in from another direction there. But and there's some funny things at that skirmish line. A couple instigators tried to start things. Instigators on the right tried to get things stirred up a little bit there.
What do you see as the danger of a film glamorizing these kinds of messages? I mean, how do you keep the...
Or the media in general.
The media in general.
I depend on the people to expose themselves, who they are on camera. The people aren't actors generally, and so they're gonna let you know who they are, you know, pretty quickly.
Well, the single great thing about all of your films is that you're very good at getting people to reveal themselves and capturing them in their off moments. So you get the kind of, it's almost very deep kind of ethnographic filmmaking. But do you need to develop a relationship with the people that you're shooting in some way? I mean, which then...
I just... come on as an everyday guy smiling, you know... glad-handing. I'm not a very threatening person, so they sort of trust me. Who could not trust me?
Oh, absolutely. And I said to you when you walked in that you're also a fashion model.
Right. I'll have some work done, and we'll see how that goes.
In one academic book about young people, the writer, and I don't even know who, Andrew Diamond said that what you filmed and what you captured in your films, in the Market Park films, showed what started there had an enduring influence on white working class youth culture that went forward. So what was kind of formed there in what you documented really became the foundation of people who developed into the kind of ideology that we're still seeing today. Do you see that? I mean, the kind of a through line from...
I am so out of the loop, and I'm happy to be out of the loop right now. I just want to, Oak Park is, a little island, and I have not... I find that, a little glass of wine during the day, and I watch Jeopardy. Sorry, I should be listening to you. I'm not prepared to make any. You're not going to get anything interesting out of me.
Well, but seeing.
I wish you would.
Okay, but seeing the people that you see today who are neo-fascists today, do you see the parallel connection to the people that you were documenting back in the 1970s? The same kind of personality.
Again, I live in a liberal paradise out there, and. Everybody picks up for their dog, and
the answer is live in a liberal paradise.
The property tax is very high, but
Tom Palazzolo is a filmmaker, many fine documentaries. We've been talking primarily about Marquette Park 1 and Marquette Park 2, where the Chicago Nazis marched in the late 70s in Marquette Park. And thanks a lot for joining us, Tom Palazzolo.
Oh, thanks for
it was great
for
fun talking
me.
With you. And Miloš Stalek, our film contributor from Facets. Good talking with you.
Hey, Jerome. Great to be here.
You don't often make portraits out of shell casings, but there are some Ukrainian artists who have made a portrait of Vladimir Putin out of shell casings. We'll talk with them next on Weekend Passport. I'm Jerome McDonnell, and you're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for Weekend Passport, where we let you know how to have an international good time on the weekend. Our global citizen friend Nari Safavi is here. Nari is one of the co-founders of the Pasvarta Arts and Cultural Exchange. Good to see you, Nari.
Good day, Jerome. It's great to be here.
We've got a couple of quick mentions. One is musical.
Yeah, one is called Milonga Comparsita at Old Town School of Folk Music. Rodrigo DJ Charrua Saraibe is originally from Montevideo in Uruguay, but he does DJ and he's an electronics engineer. And he has a knack for taking the tango music and the milonga of Argentina. He grew up in Argentina, but was born in Uruguay. And he's puts on an interesting show, and he's going to be doing that this weekend over at the Old Town.
That sounds kind of mind-blowing, doesn't it? Uruguayan tango DJ, Milonga.
Exactly. Well, you know, Uruguayans and Argentinians, they have a little bit of a battle on the claim on tango, who really started tango. And the Argentinians, because they're a much bigger country, they get a lot of credit for that. But really, there is valid narratives about how Uruguayans and Montevideans were actually the ones who really started tango.
Aha.
Yeah.
Let's swing over to another musical event that is happening in Pilsen.
Pilsen Art and Music Festival is happening this weekend. It's happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And Saturday and Sunday from noon to 10 p.m. It's on 18th Street and Blue Island Avenue in Pilsen. It's been going on since 2012, and it's a music festival centered around Mexican-American music and Mexican music, but there will also be plenty of food and family types of activities going on.
I'm going to the opening, which I think is sold out of the Pilsen Arts and Music Fest, and they've got some pretty cool musical and cultural collaborations going on between a Czech school and the National Museum of Mexican Art. They're going to have a mix of Czech and Mexican music. And they're doing a year-long project where they archive family stories and photographs of Pilsen's long tradition of diversity, creativity, and culture. So they'll talk about different generations in Pilsen.
It's very apropos because Pilsen is the name of a town actually in the Czech Republic, in the Czech lands, and now it's mostly Mexicans who are living there.
And it sounds like the musical weekend will be terrific. They've got Latin Grammy winners, all sorts of people coming in.
Exactly.
That's the Pilsen Arts and Musical Festival this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. Let's get to our featured piece, which has art.
Absolutely. It's another really good exhibition from the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art, and it's called The Five Elements of War, and it starts tonight, August 18th, and goes through September 18th. And the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art is at 2320 West Chicago, and it's a lot of really interesting art. A lot of it is actually made by actual shells from the battles that happened in Ukraine in the last few years.
It's called The Five Elements of War, and the opening reception is tonight at 7:30. And the two artists responsible are here. Daria Marchenko is here and Daniel Green as well. They have this multisensory exhibit there at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. Thank you very much for joining us. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you. It's very pleasurable for us to be here.
Tell us, why did you want to do something about the five elements of war? How did you come to say, well, we're going to really go at this and think about it?
I think because we have war in Ukraine, so war start and many of our friends die when we have revolution. I was one of the chairmen of this revolution. And we have this idea to make with bullet shell cases because only what we have after these people die, they die and only left these shell cases. So we have this idea to make a memory of these people.
And so the centerpiece of the exhibition is a portrait of Putin made entirely of shell cases.
Yes, because his face is face of war. Daria can explain it.
Face of war, and the most important in this portrait is that this face is able to change emotions depending on the lighting, and the main idea is it doesn't matter how war is lighted, but it consists of lives of humans.
And Nari, you were over and took a look at it and looked at the exhibit.
Yeah, I looked at the exhibit, and definitely the Putin piece is centerpiece to it. And it is very brilliantly conceived, and it's very easy to kind of cast this kind of a thing as a sort of an anti-Putin thing. But I actually think the Putin picture has got a bit of a Chuck Close element to it, where these shell casings, the way they have been put together from a distance, they add up to more of a picture of Vladimir Putin. But the way they have been raised and relieved within the surface of this portrait, it actually helps reflect light differently. So you get almost a feeling of your image of Putin is perspectival, depending on how the light is shifting around the painting. It's more about being more of an anti-war kind of exhibition, I would say, and it is much more about how perspectival our images are, our understandings of these kinds of concepts are.
And so there's five main concepts here: the heart of war, the flesh of war, the eye of war, the face of war, and Putin shell casing portrait is the face of war.
Yeah, and we have a brain of war. This is the most important. One of the most important things is the brain of war.
What's that one like?
This looks like grenade. It's like Russian grenade. This is sculpture 2.5 meters high. It included cameras. This is meaning informational war, because Putin fighting not only by weapon. The very important part of this war, this is an informational war, because Russian newspapers and Russian news say lie, like 90% lie.
Right. It's shaped like a grenade, which is almost the size of a vase, like kind of like in the middle of a living room. And that grenade, all the little chambers of it has the little different cameras on it. And there's actually a roll of film coming out of the top of it, too. So it's sort of like the media war basically being a grenade being launched into the middle of your brain, you could say, that is exploding your conceptions of things. So it's very symbolic and very cleverly done.
What's the Flesh of War about?
The Flesh of War, this is a painting that tells about suffer. This is like a binary opposition of the world, and the world is divided for two parts. One is in daylight and another one in nightlight. And you can see two bodies of women. This is like maps of the world. And we describe in this painting women suffer because planet, like an energy that gives life, yes, and woman that has a possibility to give life. In the result, women suffer most from the war.
It's very cleverly done in the sense that there's a female figure that's kind of a connective tissue between the continents, but the continents are formed from shells. So you can recognize the geography, but symbolism of being war, being militarism, being everywhere in the world, but yet the connective tissue of woman from two different sides, one from the front, one from the back, you being in the giving end and the receiving end of all this militarism. It's very interestingly done.
We're talking about the exhibit, The Five Elements of War. The opening reception is tonight at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. And with us are the two artists behind it, Daniel Green and Daria Marachenko. This exhibit, it was in Ukraine first. How did it go over in Ukraine?
Oh, we have a very nice partner. He's our sponsor. He's a collectioner. He's one of the greatest collectioners probably in the United States. He's Raymond Staples. He helped us to move all these things from Ukraine, and he helped to exhibit here.
Yes, we want to thank him, because without him it would not be possible to transport it, because we are talking about 1,000 kilos, because we were using not only bullet shell cases, but also splinters of bombs and other materials. It's everything is very sparkling and very heavy. And also we would like to thank Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art, because atmosphere that we have now and such a kind of deep understanding of our work, and we feel very good in this place. That's why thank you for invitation, and thank you for such kind of attitude
and
to this work.
For us, it's very important connection between American culture and Ukrainian culture, like new Ukrainian culture, because new Ukrainian culture is based on freedom, democracy, and human rights. in the United States, it happened 200 years ago, even more. Now you have a beautiful country, and I believe incorporated with the United States, our country can survive and our country can be beautiful.
Tell us about your experience in the Maidan. Did you have to drop everything and just do that full time?
We was in the Middle East, in Palestine, and in Jordan, and we're coming back in our country, and we see,
we had an art project there.
Yeah. And we see all city in fire already, revolution start. And I have experience with extreme sport. I use free rope climbing, it's like without any ropes. Oh. So for me, extreme, it's adrenaline for me is a very good thing. So I like adrenaline and I want to use my skills to help people. I like this energy of freedom and I want to help people. And long protest, this long story. And in results, they try to shoot us. They use Kalashnikov and sniper guns.
Man. How does any of this come back to the art exhibit? Do you feel it in the art exhibit?
You know, usually we are like two chatterbox. We talk to each other during hours, you know, and all the day. But after coming from Maidan, Danielle was in silence completely a few days, and I could not get some reactions from him. He lost a lot of friends. They were killed, and he just knew them, and after that he lost them, and a symbol appeared that after a live person, only one bullet there is and nothing more.
And I was in the front line. I see how it looks like. This is a horrible war. This is not fighting with stones. They use heavy rockets. They use tanks.
And grenades. People are without any equipment. And like all our friends, they are revolutionaries. I don't know why it's happened. But in this condition, we understood that our best force, this is art.
Art sometimes has more power than guns. Because in the United States, big changes after this book, Uncle Tom.
Uncle Tom's Garden.
Yeah. It's changed the history.
So art sometimes have a power to change something.
It's very moving. And that's really about how do you turn that activism into art? How does that inspire art? How does that inform one another? And is there a lot going on in Ukraine these days that's really more about that kind of art that's really stems from and is inspired by activism right now?
We have some activism, but we have not any art like this. It's only very unique art. We was make exhibition in Congress of United States. Mm-hmm. With this artwork, and many congressmen and high politicians come. Even Nancy Pelosi come to this exhibition, mm-hmm. and many different senators.
Was it hard to accumulate all the shells and the other objects you used? Was that something you could do easily?
At first, let's talk from the portrait, because we were going to spend for it a few months maybe, but we spent in a result more than half year, because we understood that we can to increase amplitude, emotional amplitude of this portrait, and we were finding with lamps all these emotions. And later we understood that it's very powerful to work with material, and due to sparkling, you know, the different level of sparkling, it allowed us to work with 3D illusions. If you will visit this exhibition, you will understand that all of paintings, they are like 3D a little bit. But also this material is very difficult, because I don't know why, but you cannot live your usual life when you work with it. You cannot go to the party, or you, I don't know, everything stopped really. And we were only in this project, and only when we were needed somewhere on some exhibitions we were coming, but not more.
Because this energy, these shells include lives, because this shell, some of them is maybe kill someone.
It was a real adventure, if to be honest.
Well, I hope people will see The Five Elements of War. It's at the Ukrainian Institute of Modern Art. The opening reception is tonight, and it runs through September 18th, so you've got a little while to see it. And Daria Marchenko and Daniel Green are the artists. Thanks a lot for joining us and talking about The Five Elements of War.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Nari Safavi, thank you for joining us as well and bringing us all the international suggestions for this weekend. Nari Safavi, thanks.
Thank you. It was a privilege to be here.
I don't know if you've heard, but there's going to be an eclipse on Monday, and it's going to actually happen during this program. We felt we had no choice but to give ourselves over to eclipse programming on Monday. So that's what we're going to be doing on Monday's show. It should be a lot of fun. We're going to go out on the deck. We've got some protective eyewear. We're going to watch it happen. We're going to have some fine segments and look back on eclipse history in the 1874 eclipse. Do you know how people used to view eclipses when they didn't have people mailing them glasses from Amazon? They used to take panes of glass and they would take a candle and blacken the glass. And that is how you viewed the eclipse back in the day. So don't try that at home. Don't be trying that this time around. But that is what happened in 1874. We'll talk about that kind of thing. We're also taking listeners who have experienced eclipse before and getting a few experiences on our hotline to get psyched. If you've experienced an eclipse before, 888-915-2270. Tell us about your eclipse experience. 888-915-2270. All the people who've called in so far, and we'll play them on Monday's program, are going back for more. They want more eclipse, and they are definitely traveling to find it. So the eclipse is going to be popular. We'll be doing it on Monday. Join us. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. Thanks to Jinghong Chen for production assistance, and thanks to Mike Gilmore for engineering. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.